Okay, let's get started. So last class, we went into a long discussion of how measurement can be thought of as what's happening inside the box and so on. And we looked at some of the conceptual features involved. So today, let's focus more on the mathematical structure. So we encountered this notion of a POVM, which I'll give you here the discrete definition or discrete case. Which is that a POVM is a set E nu such that each E nu is non-negative. And two, the sum over nu, E nu is equal to identity on the Hilbert space. And then we get the generalized, then we get postulate two. In the discrete case, which is any measurement procedure and this will be a measurement procedure with discrete outcomes. Can be described by a POVM E sub nu, which is a set of these operators. Each operator in the set is called a POVM element, an element of the POVM. Be careful, the term measurement operator means something else we'll meet later today. Such that for any row, which is a density operator on some Hilbert space, we have the Born rule, which is the probability of outcome nu. So nu is some index. So here, nu is a discrete index. Is equal to the trace of rho against E nu. Okay, so you take the matrix representing rho, which is an operator on the Hilbert space. You take the POVM element E sub nu, which is an operator on the Hilbert space. These are both matrices. You multiply them together, you take the trace, that gives you a scalar. And that's the probability of outcome nu. So we saw how this can arise in a variety of ways in previous lectures, either by doing a projective measurement on the bigger system or by doing a mixture of a convex combination of PVM measurements, of projective measurements. Any questions about this structure? And then we have the continuous case, which involves a little bit of measure theory, which I'm not prepared to review. We'll see how that goes. Okay, so continuous case is that, let me just set this up for you. So the definition of the POVM is too big. In a continuous case, now this is a scenario where you're imagining that you have, say, a pointer with a continuous set of positions. Typically, you would imagine what it's reporting to you is, you know, where is the particle on the real line? Or what is the particle's momentum on the real line? Or if you're talking about an angular momentum, where does the angular momentum point along in three-dimensional space? So those are continuous objects which we need to deal with. So where is my definition, by the way? There we go. Okay, so generally, if you're talking about probabilities over continuous sets, you talk about some set, omega, of continuous outcomes. And because the probability, so you say, what's the probability that the particle is located at x equals 2.17539, and you give me infinite number of decimals? Well, the probability is zero. It's never going to be exactly at that place. What's the probability to find the particle at position x equals 3 centimeters from my reference frame zero? Well, the probability is zero. It'll never be exactly at some real number. Okay, this is a basic problem with talking about probabilities on continuous sets. So instead, what you do, the innovation is simple. You say, well, let's just define some interval on the real line. So I'll say, what's the probability of finding the particle between 3.17 and 3.85. So I define an interval on the line, and then I ask, then I have a finite probability, 0 or 1 or 0.27, of finding the particle in that interval. So those then we can generalize that concept to something called a measurable set. So a measurable set is something where you can assign non-zero measure. It's not a single point on a continuous set. And then the formal mathematical structure for that is called a sigma algebra. So we define a sigma algebra, and we'll give it this scripted F as just to refer to it, which is really a collection of measurable subsets of omega. So the most common one is this Borel measure, which is you take the real line and you just define some open or closed interval on the real line. And then, well, let me just give that example more explicitly with words written on the board. A sigma algebra F of subsets of omega, which together, together omega and F define a measure space. So now we can actually meaningfully talk about probabilities. So as an example, now I'm doing this off the top of my head, so unless it's in here somewhere. Okay, I do have it in here, good. So basically you can talk about closed or open intervals. So we can talk about here, closed would be AB, or open would be AB intervals on R are examples of elements of a sigma algebra, very, very typical examples. Of elements X of this sigma algebra. Sorry, that's supposed to be an F with, it's supposed to be my, this is my sigma algebra F. So remember again, the elements of the sigma algebra are not the points A and B, but the intervals A and B associated with the real line. So here's X. Actually, let me call this Z, because here this is a capital X. Here capital X refers to these intervals. So then you could have, for example, this point A and this point B, and we could talk about the closed interval AB is some element of F. And then you can talk meaningfully about the probability of finding the omega is the set of outcomes in the quantum setting. Okay, so the positions of the pointer, and then The sigma algebra is, again, is finding the pointer in some region is the test. So you have outcomes and you have a test. Is the outcome in that interval? And then you would talk about the probability that Z is in X would be determined by probability theory, which in this case would be some continuous thing. So you do integral over dz from A to B of your probability density of Z. And then, so this then is a probability density. So something that's frequently confused is a probability density and a probability measure. So here's a probability density. So more generally, you write this in the form A, B, D, mu, Z, where mu is a measure. So in physics, we're more accustomed to thinking about probability density functions, which is, notice that probability densities have units of probability per unit length, and measures don't have units. So measures are like probabilities. So a normalized measure is a probability. So in mathematics, you can talk about measures that aren't normalized, but a normalized measure would have, so here normalization means the integral over R of d mu z would be equal to 1. Okay, so we normalize it so it's a probability measure. So when you normalize it, it becomes a probability measure. It's a non-negative function. You can define a general notion of integration called this Lebesgue integration. And the probability density has units. So whereas a probability measure for any element of the sigma algebra, a probability measure is going to be between 0 and 1 because it's a probability assigned to that interval. But a probability density, so just as a remark, probability densities are between 0 and infinity, right? So it's weird that it could be greater than 1. And the reason it has that is because it has units. It's probability per unit length. So the numerical value of this probability can increase if you change your definition of the unit. If you go from meters to millimeters, you get a factor of 10 to the 3, and that's going to affect the probability of finding it in that interval because it bears units. Okay, and then typically what you can do is you can go from here to here for any measure, provided that the measure is absolutely continuous with respect to this. The exact technical definition I don't remember, but the key word we call it absolutely continuous. So not all measures can be expressed with respect to a probability density. It's a subset of them, namely the subset that are physically reasonable. And that subset means you have something called, it's an absolutely continuous measure. And that allows you to take on this very familiar physics type notation. When I was talking to you about classical Liouville theory earlier in the course, I talked about the probabilities on the phase space and how they evolve. That was the time evolution of a probability density function, not a measure. Any questions about that? How many of you have seen kind of a proper discussion of sigma algebras before? Okay, very few of you. I hope that gives you a flavor of what's involved enough to kind of understand the continuous POVM. So for a POVM now, what we're gonna do is we're gonna say, okay, well, I have this region. I wanna say, is my pointer in this region X? And then what you wanna ask is, well, how can I represent that quantum mechanically? So just like in the ideal axioms, we associated projectors with the labels that are the outcomes, the pointer positions. Here what we're going to do is we're going to assign a positive operator with each element. Each element of the sigma algebra will be assigned a positive operator. And that's how we're going to take a density operator, which represents our preparation procedure. We're going to assign an operator to the interval of interest, and we're going to get a Born rule out of those two elements. Okay, so now the continuous POVM
is a map. E.
It's a map from the elements of the sigma algebra to operators. Well, let me just say F. Two linear operators on the Hilbert space. So we're taking the elements of the sigma algebra, which are these regions we can make a meaningful statement about, and we assign linear operators to them. But these linear operators are going to have to satisfy certain structural requirements so they get well-defined probabilities. And these structural requirements are, one, and here we'll say X is some element of F. Then the condition is that E of X has to be a non-negative operator. And two, we want E of omega to be equal to the identity operator. Now, a sigma algebra has certain properties to make it well-behaved. And one of the properties of a sigma algebra is that it has to include the test. Is the particle anywhere on the real line? And that is, of course, well, if there's a particle, then it's somewhere on the real line. And the answer is always yes. And so we're going to assign probability one to that element of the sigma algebra. And here, omega represents our set of all possible outcomes. So here we're saying, well, the operator associating with checking, am I going to get any outcome at all? I don't care what the value is going to be associated with the identity operator. And then the third condition is a technical condition, so the resulting objects behave like proper probabilities. And so these two constraints are directly analogous to what we saw for the discrete POVM. The third condition is because of the fact that we're dealing with a continuous space, and we can define, clearly I can define, if I can define a region AB, I can also define a region CD. But now the problem is CD and AB share a joint area. So we want to make sure we're doing the right kind of bookkeeping to make sure we're not double counting these regions. Okay, so as a bookkeeping condition, we say that the what I'm drawing is a different example. Let me make this one this case. So I have this region CD, and I have this region, which is my AB region. And if I want to talk about the probability of being in AB or being in CD, then I want to be able to represent that by some operator. And so the constraint is that the positive operator associated with a union of two different elements of the sigma algebra is going to be a positive operator, is going to be a sum over the positive operators associated with each of those regions. So this is going to allow me to add regions in a sensible way and assign positive operators associated with the pointer being in two different sets of intervals. But this is only going to be true for disjoint sequences. For just disjoint sequences. Okay, my notation is, okay, so this is bad notation. So each xi is an element of f. But this means, these brackets mean the set of xi. So the set of xi's are a subset of f. So let me just write that properly. So what this disjoint sequences constraint does is it says I'm not going to add the probabilities if the regions aren't disjoint, because then I'm double counting incorrectly. And then there's a technical point where this can, in principle, be an infinite sum. And then you have to deal with some analysis. So you say, well, this is only this relationship is only well-defined or required to converge in the weak topology if this is an infinite thing. So for those of you who love analysis, this, you know, for infinite sum, we require only convergence in the weak topology. And that sounds really fancy. All it means is convergence in the weak topology just means that you want the sequences to converge with respect to some set of test functions. So they don't need to converge like pointwise. You just define some family of test functions and you want them to be indistinguishable with respect to that family of test functions. And that family of test functions is going to be actually the functions induced by your density operators, the allowed set of states. So you only care about how these guys act on states because that's the only way they appear. So let me show you what the Born rule looks like for this kind of object, and then we'll all take some questions. So then we have a generalized Born rule, which here I gave you postulate 2 in the discrete case. So now let me give it to you in the continuous case. And let me also do that on a fresh board over here. So in the continuous case, you talk about, and let me just make sure I get it right the first time and follow my notes so I don't miss anything. Okay, so the usual blah, blah, blah about any measurement procedure can be described by such a structure. So I'll just skip that. So we have, it can be described by, any general measurement procedure can be described by a POVM E, which I guess I don't draw it as a set here, but as a map, which takes elements of the sigma algebra to linear operators, satisfying those conditions. Such that for any density operator D on the Hilbert space, acting on the Hilbert space, representing our preparation procedure, the probability that the outcome, namely the pointer position, is in some interval x, is associated with probability of Ex. So remember, think of it this way. E is a map from sigma algebra elements to linear operators. So that means for every element of the sigma algebra, this map has defined some operator. And E of X is that operator here. So this is the operator associated with that interval. No, man, I'm writing it wrong. Probability of X is equal to, so probability of X, remember what this means is the probability that some element lambda of omega, so let lambda be an element of omega. Here we're asking that lambda is in X. So this actually means the probability that lambda is in X, which you can just write as the probability. There's two ways to say this in words, the probability that the outcome is in the interval, or just the probability of that interval being the outcome, is equal to the trace of E of X against rho. So that's the most general Born rule you will encounter. Takes into account real-world measurements, which involve doing measurements on composite systems and convex combinations of measurements, and we're allowing for continuous outcomes. And of course, the discrete case follows as a special case, because then I can always define omega to be, omega is just a set. So if omega is a set that has a finite number of elements, or a countable number of elements, then the sigma algebra becomes trivial. It's just the set of indices indicating all those different elements and subsets of those elements. And then we recover the discrete case. So the POVM becomes, the third condition for the POVM becomes meaningless, and it's only the first two conditions which we recover the discrete case. So this subsumes the discrete case. So I don't think that
we're not going to spend much time doing examples of this because it's something which comes up a lot in kind of quantum information, but this is a general course. I won't go into too many details, but I'll provide it to you so you have a fully general description of the properties of quantum mechanics and whatever you would do after the fact. But let me give you one example of a POVM in the discrete case. Before I give you an example of a POVM, does anybody have any questions about the mathematical structure? Okay. So by non-trivial here, I just mean the fact that POVMs include PVMs as a special case, so your usual notion of projective measurement based on some set of joint operator with discrete spectrum. So that usual notion kind of follows up from all of this and as a special case. So let me give you an example of this POVM structure where it can't be described as a self-adjoint operator on the system of interest. And so this is called the trine measurement. From the trine POVM measurement. Trine POVM. So what we want to do is we want to define three projectors that are non-orthogonal. So this is a measurement on a qubit. So if we had a regular measurement from ideal quantum mechanics, the projectors would be orthogonal. They project onto orthogonal subspaces of the Hilbert space. But in this case, they're not going to do that. So in fact, what we're going to have is define some plane in the Bloch sphere. We're going to define the Mercedes-Benz symbol. So there you have the further vectors n1, n2, and n3. Now, okay, this looks like Cartesian coordinates in three-dimensional space. It is not that. So instead we have this is 120 degrees. Okay, so this refers to a plane in R3. Or I think the 3 goes up here. And so these are our three vectors. Okay, so notice that mi.nj So normally we would put hats on these because they would be unit vectors, but here they're not unit vectors. Is not equal to 0. So these are not the Cartesian components, x, y, z. So we're going to assign a projector chi nu where each vector in this projector is the plus one eigenstate of, I take my Pauli operators, which now I'll use a hat because they're operators. So the Pauli operators correspond to Pauli X, Pauli Y, and Pauli Z. And I'm going to take an inner product between this Pauli vector, which now points anywhere, just an arbitrary Pauli vector, and I'm going to take its inner product with this n sub nu, which is a unit vector pointing along one of these three directions. And I'm going to define its plus one eigenstate. So I want the vectors associated. So if I take n1 to be the z-axis, and I take this to be the z-y plane, then n1 would just be the plus one eigenstate of sigma z. n2 would be would not be the eigenstate of any Pauli operator, because it's the eigenstate of any of the three xyz Paulis. It's the eigenstate of a rotated Pauli operator. And now I can define my P of the M, which is a set of operators, E sub nu, where nu is equal to 1, 2, or 3, in the proper notation. It's a set, nu is an element of that set. Where each E nu is equal to 2/3 chi nu. And now the point is you can then check that, so then the Born rule for this operator, for this POVM measurement, would look like this. The probability of outcome nu is equal to the trace of d nu rho. And then we want to check that it's a valid POVM. So what are the two conditions we check? We check one, that each e nu is greater than or equal to zero for every nu. And of course, that's obvious because a projector is a positive operator, and we're just multiplying by 2/3, so it's still a positive operator. And then the other condition is that we want the sum over nu of each e nu to be equal to identity. And how easy is that? Okay, but I'm not going to do it off the top of my head, but you can just check. You check yourselves. And so then we have a valid view of the M. Any questions about that? Yeah.
You defined it to be 120 degrees between the.
Yeah, sorry, this was my definition of the unit vector. So these are just unit vectors, so n sub nu is just some vector in S2. And I command that will be the arc cos of ni dot nj is equal to, is this right? Am I doing this right? You guys should see this immediately. This one right? I mean, I'm just trying to do some kindergarten geometry here. So you have two vectors. The inner product is going to be and so these are unit vectors, I'm good. Okay, so that's all I need. So this figure was a definition. Any other questions? Yes.
So in general, could you pick n's just like pointing randomly everywhere in the block sphere, and then just if you have like n vectors, do 1/n. That gives you some POVMs.
I don't know if it would be 1/n, but there would be some normalization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. That would define some POVM. As long as, they have to sum to identity. So you have to make sure that it's normalized properly.
Okay.
And you can define some more. So let me make two remarks. One of which is important, and one of which is for advanced users. Okay, so two remarks. So the first remark is that How do I implement this? So remember, my onslaughts is that the three postulates I gave you for ideal quantum mechanics give you all the structural information you need to describe quantum systems. So when I say how do I implement this, what I mean is how do I take this abstract structure and give me a protocol I can follow where I'm only using the elements of ideal quantum mechanics. I'm only using unitaries and self-adjoint operators to implement the black box. So I have some black box. You know, your supervisor says, go to the lab, build me a black box, which has a pointer and a light and a dial. And I want this box to implement the trying POVM. How would you do it? Okay, so this is actually a good exercise. And I don't want you to give me the exact answer because it requires some computation, but just philosophically, like, what would you look for? What I'm fishing for here is the von Neumann indirect measurement method we saw last class. Okay, so we saw how we could implement a measurement on a system by introducing an ancilla system, which I call the apparatus system. And then we have some initial state of that apparatus, which we can choose, some ready state of the apparatus system. And then we write down some general unitary that entangles the input state into my box, my system input state. There's some unitary, there's some fixed initial state of the apparatus, and there's my arbitrary density operator of the system. And I design a unitary that's going to couple these, and I design a projective measurement, postulate 2 of ideal quantum mechanics, postulate 1 of ideal quantum mechanics, via von Neumann's indirect, I choose U and I sub nu, such that the trace of rho s tensor 0,0 on the apparatus, U dagger identity tensor pi nu u reproduces this. So then the hard work is to find a u and the projected measurement on the ancilla is going to do that. So that's good. What's another way to do it? By kind of cheating. I'm allowing you to put a little homunculus inside the box, which should just be a computer program. And I'm allowing you, okay, this is gonna be hard. I'm allowing you to put a little program inside the box. And I'm also allowing you to reject sometimes. So remember, inputting the state, what that means is I'm inputting some invisible system, and this is my description of that invisible system. And now the usual assumption is that every time my preparation device, every time I click on the go button, the light goes off. So that means my probabilities add up to 1. If I press the go button and the light doesn't go off, it means either the system never entered into the box, so either there was a failure of emitting a quantum system, or there was a failure of this box, it received the quantum system but failed to see it, the measurement, or something failed. So you have these failures. So failures correspond to subnormalized quantum states or subnormalized quantum measurements. So subnormalized measurements are measurements that don't add to identity, which means that, remember, what's the probability of getting any outcome? The probability of getting any outcome comes from omega is any outcome, identity operator. I put identity operator into here, I can trace a rho equal to 1. So the probability of getting any outcome is 1, which means the light will always go off and I don't care what the pointer is. But you can certainly design a measurement which doesn't work sometimes. And you can design that measurement to not work on purpose sometimes for strategic reasons, like violating Bell's theorem with classical devices, with classical input states. But here what I just want to get at is that if your supervisor didn't tell you that the box has to work every time, that wasn't in part of the design criteria, then the easy way to do this, what's the easy way to do this? So that it works some fraction of the time correctly, and the rest of the time just doesn't report a result at all. Okay, so if the answer is something you'll all recognize, what I can do is I can just do a good old Stern-Gerlach measurement up and down along sigma z. I can rotate the Stern-Gerlach device to measure sigma z along this new axis, or sigma z along this axis. Now the problem is, if I'm measuring along this axis, sometimes I'll get the outcome minus 1. And that's not one of the allowed outcomes here. And when I rotate the device to do this measurement, sometimes I get the outcome minus 1 here. And similarly, if I rotate this way, I sometimes get the outcome minus 1 here. So I could just design it by this cheaper way, and then whenever I get a disallowed outcome, I just don't report any result at all. So the device will only work the fraction of the time that I get one of the allowed outcomes. And I can simulate this system. And the reason for bringing this up, other than to get you guys thinking more creatively about what these measurements mean, is that I promised you earlier in the course, I said, hey, the Cochin Specker model of the qubit, which is just a gyroscope where you don't know the direction of the gyroscope, I can reproduce anything you want to do with the qubit. Any preparation, transformation, measurement you want, I can reproduce with that model. If the design criteria for this box is that it always reports an outcome, so I can't use this cheaper method, and I have to use the dilation method, then it turns out I can't use the Cochin Specker model to reproduce this measurement. So the trine POVM is a measurement on a single qubit which cannot be reproduced by the simple classical model. And the reason is that I'm bringing in extra quantum resources. So if I do a resource counting of how many qubits did I need to implement this measurement, well, I needed the qubit that's carrying the system information, and I need this ancilla qubit in order to realize this three outcome measurement. And so I call this, for this reason, the trine POVM, I call this an improper POVM. In analogy to improper quantum states. Improper density operators are density operators that require entanglement with another Hilbert space to be realized. But that set was equal to the set that could be realized by convex combination. But here, this is a POVM which cannot be realized by convex combination. It can only be realized by dilating the system and bringing in extra quantum resources. So it's just good to know that there's this distinction in terms of when do you need and when do you not need extra quantum resources to realize some generalized measurement procedure. That's just kind of a sidebar comment. Any questions about that? Okay. So, you can ask a question.
Excuse me, could you give an example of what your U might look like for that?
the U.
The unitary. The.
Yeah, I don't even remember. So I can change a couple ways to do it. Remember this distinction. So what would it look like? Well, I don't know off the top of my head. You know, I've seen it before. I just don't remember. But there is an interesting way to do this, which is different than this structure. Remember, I introduced this notion of this tensor product notation, where you bring in extra quantum resources corresponding to new degrees of freedom. And then there's also this tensor sum notation. Where you just kind of, it's like if an electron is confined in some region, and then you enlarge the region along that same axis, you are adding more accessible states without bringing in a new degree of freedom. You're kind of changing the boundaries of the degree of freedom. A better example is this. If I have an atom that's constrained to be within some manifold of eigenstates, so the ground state and say the first three eigenstates, and then there's a big gap to the next eigenstate, energy eigenstate. So because of the energetics, the kinematics of the system, you might be constrained to this lower manifold. But then if you can introduce energy in the system, all of a sudden the electron can access these higher energy states. So that's like tensor summing in additional Hilbert space. So it turns out you can realize this measurement by tensor summing in a third level and creating an effective three-level system. And this unitary would rotate you from the subspace into that larger three-dimensional Hilbert space. So while I can't give you an explicit example, just those are two different ways to implement it. Okay. So let me ask the following question. Can any POEM mathematical structure be realized physically via the ideal axiom? So the answer is yes, we can. So that promises that there's an answer to this. And it turns out that, in fact, just like I showed you here, any POBM can be realized by a von Neumann's indirect measurement method. By just making this ancilla space large enough and judiciously choosing a unitary and a projective measurement on the ancilla alone, which means you can always have a state update. Okay, the advantage of, in principle, we can realize the Born rule by doing this unitary and doing a projective measurement on both the system and ancilla. But it's valuable to know that you can always restrict the projective measurement to the ancilla alone, so that then you can deduce what the update rule is. It turns out that will be non-unique in some cases. So the answer is yes. And this result is important enough that the resulting theorem has a name. So this is called Neimark's dilation theorem. This is, I think, a Russian name, so sometimes it's spelled this way. So for any P of M, there exists a PBM, P, such that the trace of P of X rho is equal to the trace of rho tensor 0 P of X. Is a linear operator on HA. Let me call this HA then. So P is a projective measurement on a bigger Hilbert space. And this is for any row of any density operator D on HA, and for any EX, which is an element of a POBM. And then a corollary is that P of X always be chosen in the form identity tensor pi x, and this is the von Neumann instrument, the von Neumann indirect measurement. Pi of x is a linear operator on HB alone. In other words, you do no measurement on the system, and you do a measurement on pi of x. So here you would have something like P of x would be equal to U dagger identity tensor pi of x U. Okay, so the difference between these two pictures is that in one case, we introduce our ancilla system and our row on system A, and you just do some big old joint projective measurement on both systems. Or we can think of this as some unitary, and then a measurement on the ancilla alone. So you see the relationship between here, we're just putting this into a box, and that allows us to have an output state that's well defined. Because if I write my measurement of this form, then it might be a destructive measurement where the system is consumed in the process of measurement, so we don't have a well defined output state, like by absorbing a photon or something. But here, this guarantees that we're not doing that kind of measurement because the system of interest isn't actually measured. It's just unitarily coupled to another system, which by definition doesn't destroy it, and then you can possibly destructively measure the ancilla, which we don't care about anymore anyway. So this would be the output to the measuring box. Okay, so this means we can always do a POBM measurement if we believe that the ideal axioms can always be realized. Okay, so I'm ready to move on to transformations, just to see what generalized transformations look like. Last chance questions here. these guys aren't asking very many questions. It's Monday, because this is a lot of information to absorb. Or because...
Right, so I'm just confused about this implementation of the POVM. So I'm trying to figure out why we need to go to this this larger system in order to actually make the measurements. Why is that necessary?
It's not always necessary. It's only necessary for some POVMs. POVMs that are not... Let me start from the top. So I gave you three postulates for the structure of quantum mechanics. We were done. Okay, so then we can just say, look, I can always think about everything I do in terms of these three postulates. Nymark's theorem says, if you want to describe a measurement to me, just describe it in terms of the ancilla space and the projective measurement on the system in ancilla space, and don't talk to me about POVMs. I don't want to hear about it, all right? So we can definitely do that. But it's convenient. There's two answers. The correct answer is that it's convenient to be able to have operators that are defined only on the Hilbert space of interest. And the reason for that is the ancillas involved for describing the most general thing you can do, you're carrying around in your mathematical modeling, whether you're using Mathematica or doing the calculation by hand, you're carrying around all this extra Hilbert space, these maybe even infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces in your computation, whereas you can just have a shorthand notation, which is just some, if you're dealing with a d-dimensional system, this is a d by d matrix. So if I want to compute the Bordwell probability compared to experiment, I have a d by d matrix times a d by d matrix, I just multiply them together and I take the trace. If you do it this way, then you're carrying around a d by d matrix to describe your system state, or if you want an ideal vector, let's assume the state is ideal, and it's a d-dimensional column vector. Now I want to describe this more general measurement procedure, which involves coupling the system to an apparatus system and human measurement. So then I carry around maybe that's an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Maybe it's a set of systems that are required to implement this. So then you're carrying around all of this description in your calculation, which is not necessary. You just write down a simple effective model. So the more general description is more powerful, as we'll see, and you haven't seen why yet, but it's more cumbersome. So that's what I think is the correct answer. Now, you will hear another answer from almost everybody else in the field, which is this. They want to take these things as being primitives. Then when I talk about the postulates of quantum mechanics, I want to talk about this set of objects, this POVM structure, as my fundamental starting point for describing measurements on quantum systems. And I think that's wrong. And you'll see why, actually, probably within the next two lectures, we'll discuss how there are phenomena which are observed in the lab that are not captured by these heuristic objects. And it's an important distinction, because people are spending their entire research careers and their students' research careers investigating ways to derive these mathematical structures from a set of physical postulates. And so if I'm right and they're wrong, then those people are wasting their time. So that's why it's actually one of the biggest areas of foundations now. It's people trying to derive the postulates, but they don't try and derive the ideal axioms, they try and derive these general axioms. They want a set of physical postulates that will imply that the general structure is a POVM rather than a self-adjoint operator.
So in real life, we usually start with the self-adjoint operators, and there are now some people who want to derive the E's from them.
Yeah, POVMs, yeah. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, sorry, I'm in the camp that might more or less disagree. But you said something like there are phenomena and things that you can observe in the lab that cannot be modeled. Mm-hmm. You said it in short for a reason. But can you explain exactly what you mean? Do you mean to say that both the POVM and PVM measurement models are insufficient for describing some?
No, just the POVM model.
Just the POVM?
So the PVM model, if you allow me to carry around the extra Hilbert space in my modeling,
right,
then I can describe effects that cannot be described with the POVM approach. And that's the same as, it's true of POVMs. The example is simpler and clearer in the case of transformation. So you already know this. The next step of the class is going to introduce you to what are called completely positive trace preserving maps, which is this more general structure of describing transformations, which includes coupling to other systems. And then people take that as a starting point for what the postulates should be for transformations. And I'll give you an example of a transformation which cannot be described by a CPTP map on the system alone, because that structure is derived under assumption, and you just violate that assumption, which is, when I was at MIT 10 years ago, we did an experiment, and we couldn't explain the results of the CPTP map, and we realized it was because there was an additional correlation in the model which cannot be accounted for by a CPT map for sure.
What would their argument be in defense of the belief that this is more fundamental?
Oh, no, nothing. My initial opposition to what you said was like, okay, but PVMs are a special case of a POVM.
Yeah.
Right? But you're more interested in making statements about all of the correlations you can observe when you're talking about just the system.
Yeah.
In comparison to the system plus other information
exactly.
that you have to keep track of.
Yeah.
And so when you have more realistic examples, yeah, I see what you mean.
But what was the arguments in favor? I don't know, that's a good question. I mean, I think that there's
a... You can accommodate more and you can describe the same correlations on a smaller system.
I think
but,
that one, if people that don't talk to experimentalists enough.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of in their theory ivory tower doing stuff. And then people, mathematicians tend to be attracted to simple mathematical structures. And there is something to be said for the simplicity of the... Actually, I think they're both kind of elegant and simple. Well, I guess maybe you guys seeing this for the first time don't think of a POVM as the most simple mathematical structure, but once you get familiar with it, you might have a different view, and there is a certain kind of simplicity to the picture. But I think that's a great question for operations. So ask Rob Speckens, who's on the third floor here. We argue about this all the time. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused with that. Like what you're saying is not what you've written there. So
you stare lightly.
The color are you? So,
where are
we? Color are we? So, you're saying that for any P, I can write it as a unitary transformation plus a projective measurement only in the Ancilla system.
Yeah.
It's not that Po can be written as a, sorry, that P is a measurement just in the Ancilla without the unitary transformation. No. Makes sense.
That means backwards?
Yeah.
Well, you is undefined. So
the words you've written are different from the example you've given. If you've seen your words, just the P
right.
You just plug that back
okay.
in.
It can always be realized. Via some U. As a measurement. Does this help? Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, did you say POVMs are not self-adjoint operators? So there's like a difference between POVMs and self-adjoint operators or something?
That's a good question. So at one point I looked into this, and I believe that if an operator is non-negative, it has to be self-adjoint. But that might have only been true for density operators, which have an additional constraint of being trace one. So I don't recall the proof and if it depends on this trace one condition. But remember, a non-negative operator, if I just say A is non-negative, then what I mean by that is that in whichever Hilbert space A is acting on, so A is some linear operator, saying it's non-negative means that and also, if A is diagonalizable, that means that it has positive, not negative eigenvalues. And then, if we restrict, restrict the finite dimensional systems, and the question is, does this imply that A equals a dagger? Let's see. I would say, okay, so I don't know, but I think that positionally, if you assume you find a dimensional Hilbert space, when things get simpler and self-adjoint, is what easier to understand. And if you possibly also assume that A is trace class, which means it's a finite trace, then this I'm pretty sure this follows. So I looked into it a while ago and convinced myself that it was true. But I can't reproduce it right now.
Can you write any POVM as a linear combination of just PVMs?
No. A linear combination? Oh, yes.
Okay.
PVMs. You definitely write it as a linear combination of linear operators for reasons which I'll tell you guys later, which is really cool. And then can you do it as a linear combination of projectors? Probably. I can definitely write it as a linear combination of Hermitian operators. Let's just stick to finite dimensions. You can definitely write it as a linear combination of Hermitian operators, which are an operator basis for the Hilbert space. And then each of those Hermitian operators could be diagonalized in terms of a spectral decomposition, giving another linear combination of those projectors. So yeah, so for finite dimensions, any operator can be expressed as a linear combination of projectors.
Okay. With real coefficients or with general?
With real... No.
What was my starting point for the assumption about the operator? Was it any which kind of operator? Any linear operator or any Hermitian linear operator?
And I was asking if any POVM can be written.
Oh, any POVM. Yeah, they are all be real coefficients for POVM because it's not negative.
Okay. Well, then you can say that POVMs are self-adjoint because they're linear combinations of PVMs with real coefficients.
Is the whole point of what you called an improper POVM is there are POVM sets that cannot be written as probabilistic mixtures of PVMs?
Yes.
And so what he's saying is something that's a relaxation of what that statement is, right? Like if you allow for like real value.
Saying, he was saying real coefficients.
Yeah.
Not
okay.
Negative.
Yeah. So you're saying that you can always do that. Let your coefficients be, say, negative or greater than 1.
That's my guess.
Okay.
Yes,
it seems reasonable.
Provisional.
Yeah.
This is all provisional because I'd have to check it. Okay, let's go a little bit longer. We started a bit late. All right, so just as a show of hands, how many of you are happy to see kind of this generalized formulation of quantum mechanics taking into account other Hilbert spaces that you may or may not be neglecting in your description?
Is this a question?
How many of you are happy to see it? Like, how many of you find this kind of interesting and valuable as opposed to kind of feel like it's, you know, option B is, I don't see how this is going to be relevant to you. So option A, don't be offended. Option B, okay, good. And of course, as the professor, I'm allowed to tell you if you need to know. So, rely on what you think you need to know. I definitely will then give a light-handed treatment of the transformations as open systems, because now I think you see now the general structure. So let me just highlight the structure for you. So the first generalization is we're going to do convex combinations, and I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to tell you because it's really simple. Convex combinations of unitary operators. Here we have some map lambda, which is going to take an input state and produce an output state. You can define this map to be a probabilistic combination of unitary. So I apply unitary u sub I to my input state with some probability v sub I. And then the other way to do it is to imagine I have some transformation on rho, which is obtained by a tracing out some ancilla system B, where I have rho tensor sigma B u dagger. We say u is then a unitary operator, which is a special linear operator, on h tensor hb. Here I drop the subscript a on the first system. The unsubscripted system is the system of interest, one to the left of the tensor product. And sigma b is some density operator on hb. Okay, so this is the scenario we just looked at for binomials in direct measurement. We're coupling the two systems. But now we're not interested in doing a measurement or anything like that. We just want to talk about what is the transformation of the system of interest. So in this case, too, is a scenario where you have sigma b, and you have rho, and you do unitary, and then you just don't care about this system. This one. The system goes into a trash can, you don't know anything about it, and then you're happy to describe rho prime. So throwing something in the trash can is called partial trace without looking at it or conditioning on it in any way. Okay, so then in both cases, we have the fact that lambda takes density operators to density operators. We have that the trace of rho prime is equal to 1 if the trace of rho capital trace and lowercase trace are the same thing. So this means it's positive. So we say that the map lambda is a positive map that takes positive operators to positive operators, and we say that it's trace preserving if it takes normalized states and returns normalized states. Now it turns out that and then we can do the same routine as before. We can define this class of maps. We can write down a postulate for them, and we can then say. Then we ask the final question I asked in both previous cases for states and measurements. I said, can we realize any such map physically? And then for these, the answer is no. And this isn't related to our debate. This is a separate question. So it turns out there's another constraint we have to impose for these to be physically realizable. So we have another constraint. Another constraint for these generalized transformations to be realizable. To be guaranteed to be physically realizable When I say physically realizable, I mean one physically realizable. And I also mean via the ideal axioms, via some dilation. But let me just leave that undefined for now. And so how many of you know what this other condition is? You do. Did you see it? You guys didn't see it in the initial course material? The other condition is called complete positivity. Is that ringing a bell to anyone? No. Right, so this condition is called complete positivity. And it's basically saying that if I have a joint system, positivity is this. Given here's sigma b, here's rho, and then here's my effective map u, and then this is equal to rho prime is equal to lambda rho, which if we just write as a black box, rho prime, and then we label this black box lambda. So the point is, if lambda is just positive and trace preserving, then we can get unphysical scenarios where suppose I have a new Hilbert space H tensor HC. So this is HB, and this is H. Now I bring in another Hilbert space HC, and then what I do is I prepare some entangled state psi, where psi is an element of HA, sorry, let me call it A, H tensor HC. And then I apply my box lambda to A alone. Well, here I'm mixing notations here. In the circuit picture, we don't put our steam pump input output. So here we just have some lambda maps on system A. This is HC here. And then we get some output state phi. Or rather, I should call it phi, we call it omega, which is some linear operator on H tensor HC. Just one second. So then a necessary and sufficient condition. Actually, I guess it's the definition. This is the definition. So we say lambda is completely positive. I'm going to make sure I get the wording straight here. Acting on psi. Okay, so what does this mean?
This means I'm tensoring two quantum transformations together. So this is my quantum transformation on system A. And this is my quantum transformation on system C. And this capital I means it's the do-nothing transformation. It's the identity transformation, not the identity state, the identity transformation. So if I take the map lambda and I extend it by doing nothing on some ancilla, where I have some input state, which is entangled across the, it only matters if it's entangled, but this state is entangled across A and C, and we'll revisit entanglement shortly so you have a fuller picture of that. As long as we have a positive input state, we get a positive output state. When we tensor with identity, then we say it's completely positive. So you need this to be true. And this is important because I mentioned to you earlier in the class that there's an interesting open question about how to detect if a mixed state is entangled. And we'll discuss that. And we'll find out that there's a partial answer to that question, and it involves a distinction between a positive and a completely positive operation. Essentially, the only way you can expose that a map is positive versus completely positive is to test it on entangled states. And so just to give you kind of a foreshadowing, we're going to be able to construct maps which then are tests for entanglement because they become, because they don't, on entangled states, they don't reproduce this condition. Yeah?
Do you mean to have the lambda tensor identity C on the right as well? Or no? Like in this omega?
Why wouldn't it be on the right? I can put it anywhere I want, but...
No, I just mean like a sandwich between on the state side. Like, are you evolving the pure state psi or doing something else?
Thank you. No. Psi is in HA tensor HC.
Okay.
So the projector psi, so that means the projector state psi is a linear operator on H tensor HC. And this is a map acting on those linear operators,
okay,
returning a linear operator omega, which is also H tensor HC. Okay, we will review this and discuss some of its features next class. And we'll talk about entanglement and tests for entanglement, where you see the structure of this big open problem of identifying entanglement with mixed states. Okay, thanks for your questions and attention.